It's before most of our time on the planet, but people used to have to ask workers to get things off the shelves in grocery stores for them. There was no wide self-service in the days before supermarkets. Boy, did that change. Now we can order things to buy with a single click on a website, and we have so much information about the products we buy. The sellers, likewise, compile a bit of information about us. This is the age of big data. It changes many things, the retail relationship among them. Our guest this hour is one of the authors of Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. It is written by Victor Meyer-Schoenberger and Thomas Ramge. Victor Meyer-Schoenberger is professor of Internet Governance and Regulation at the Oxford Internet Institute, University of Oxford. He conducts research into the network economy. Thomas Ramge is the tech correspondent for a German business magazine and also writes for The Economist. Thomas is our guest. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, it's great to be there. Hi, Jeff.
Good to have you. So eBay is cited right up front in the book, which is rather old school, I guess, by tech terms now. But what are some of the changes that eBay really sort of burst upon the world?
Yeah, you just said it is old school. It felt old school for a long time, as it was obviously one of the first big online marketplaces. But then when it grew bigger and bigger, it was much more difficult to search for its clients to find the right products. And what we describe in the beginning of the book is how eBay faced the challenge that it was a huge market, but also a market where you wouldn't easily find what you're looking for because it was so plenty of product and therefore so plenty of information. And the big change we're describing in our book is not only that markets or online markets are becoming full of products, but also rich of information, which ends up or that a data-rich market is only a good market if sellers can describe their products in a searchable way, and if clients have the filters and the tools to access the information they need in an easy and comfortable way. And that basically, we chose eBay as the starting example in our book because we had the impression that they sort of fall behind in searchability of their marketplace, and they discovered that this was their problem and that they've decided on a big initiative to make their market more explorable and therefore to make their market not only rich of products but also rich of data.
So in this division that you describe in the book between data-rich markets and conventional markets, has eBay sort of relegated itself up to this point as more of a conventional market? We're just going to have to walk the store and look at things in a sense?
Yeah. Exactly. And that, yeah. And as opposed to Amazon, who obviously did a very, very good job in offering, first of all, filters, which help you to look easily for products that you were looking for. And second of all, by using machine, recommendation engines obviously are very effective in the sense that we know that they create about a third of the sales of Amazon. And that is basically a very, very intelligent use of data in all the good and all the bad senses that you could imagine.
Right. So they've got a lot of information on you while you get information on the products as well. You move on to a concept here that I hadn't heard of before the book, blah, blah car. What is that?
BlaBlaCar is, I think, the biggest carpooling company of the world. It's a half-European, half-American startup, very popular in France, as the founder is French. And, the name BlaBlaCar is derived, and that's why we're using this example in the book, from the fact that they have, for carpooling, invented a new dimension. They call it the chattiness factor. Regarding that, if you use carpooling, if you drive somewhere and you've decided to take someone with you, a very, very important dimension, if that is a good experience for the client and for the driver, is if you are the type of, if you are people who get along in terms of your chattiness factor, meaning that if you have a very, very talkative person on the one hand and someone who really doesn't like to talk very much, they won't have a good ride together. And so The chattiness factor is sort of, for us, it's a good example that shows how a data-rich economy and how data-rich markets describe dimensions of products with data that hadn't been described beforehand in conventional markets.
So much more information can be conveyed. You can get to the point of where you're not just trying to figure out the price for your ride, but how much the driver's going to talk to you and all the other stuff that goes with that.
Or what kind of music he likes, or if he likes pattern, or even, and what kind of films he likes, so that you might have a good starting point for a conversation because you share an interest in movies or whatever. And, you were hinting it. The price doesn't become really important in that context anymore. And the BlaBlaCar example is a good example in the sense that price on this market doesn't play a role at all anymore because the price is regulated. So someone who wants to get a ride from someone can't really choose by price. He can only choose by, is that person driving from A to B at the right time? And is the person with a high likelihood a good match for me? And that what data-rich markets are all about. They are about better matches. And obviously, price still doesn't play a role in it, but only in the sense that do I have the price or the money within my budget? But it's not anymore like in conventional markets, the most important signal on which we base our decisions. We are in a data-rich market. People go really look for what they want and what they need. And as we as humans have never been very good in conveying a large amount of information in our head and juggling it around and then take good decisions, we only look to a very, very simple form of information, that was price. Price was a sort of a signal in which we were assuming that all information of a market had been condensed into.
All right, but now we're moving beyond price. We'll explain much more about how when we come back and talk more with Thomas Ramga about reinventing capitalism in the age of big data, back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the way the world has changed and how we buy and sell things. So much more information is available to us now other than just price and quantity and color and things like that. Henry Ford would not get away with being able to just produce Model Ts in basic black in today's world. And this is all well demonstrated in a book by Victor Meyer Schoenberger and Thomas Ramga, Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. Thomas Ramga is our guest on The Exchange, a tech correspondent for German Business Magazine, also a writer for The Economist, so writes a lot about the interface of the internet and business. You can join us on The Exchange. Questions and comments welcome by phone at 800-838-3760, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So what we're talking about here is ultimately in data-rich markets, a greater efficiency in matching up purchaser and seller, because the features that are offered by one are accepted by the other. And as you point out, in that context, price becomes a whole lot less important.
That's true. I mean, but what is money? Let's put it that way. Money has three main economic roles. One is to store value. The other one is to make that store value transferable from person A to B, or from organization A to organization B. And the third is that it conveys information. By the classic economic theory, all information available on a market are condensed in a single data point, and that single data point is the price. And that was very helpful in conventional markets. As I said before, we as human beings, our brain is not very, very good comparing different products with different dimensions. I give you a very simple example. For example, you like sweet fruit and you prefer organic fruit, organic fruit in contrast to conventionally farmed food. And then you go to the supermarket and you get sweet banana but they're unfortunately conventionally farmed, and you get rather sour apple, but they are organic. What do? You don't know, because you have to compare different dimensions and different preferences. And this very simple example, and what do? You look at the price. Because the price then gives you a sort of a quick fix for your dilemma or for your problem to solve. And the beauty of data-rich markets will be that we'll, thanks to digital technology, we'll be much more able, or much more often be able to do comparisons that are more complex, and that we don't have to fall back as often to the price as a very simple category. Which obviously doesn't mean that the first two functions of money, the store of value and the ability to transfer money with to transfer value with money, that they'll obviously persist.
So, Thomas, does this really cut down on impulse buying as markets get more data rich? I mean, do people not feel as inclined to, like, buy those little gewgaws at the cash register? A, because they're not at the cash register as much, and B, because it doesn't fit what they plan to get.
Yeah, and maybe because your digital assistant on your smartphone says you don't need that because he knows your preferences and he knows what you have in your fridge already. You know, impulse buying is often driven, obviously, I mean, it's a sort of very irrational or irrational form of buying. And hopefully data will help us to be better informed consumers, and consumers that are not only better informed, but they're always also able to process the information they have in a better way, in a smarter way.
Thomas Ramge is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Victor Meyer-Schoenberger of Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. Here's a call from Deborah in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Deborah, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having my question.
Sure, go ahead.
This is so interesting to listen to, and what it brings up for me, especially hearing about BlaBlaCar and the idea of matching up compatible riders, makes me think that it's sort of this pre-set up way, just like we have on Facebook and online and on my email, where they show me ads for things that I might want, but it means I don't get to see the other choices. If I do this BlaBlaCar thing with someone who they've decided is compatible because of a questionnaire I answered, I don't get to meet people with other opinions, other cultural opportunities for me, choices for me to even change who I am and how I want to be just because of having reached out into the world and experienced so much other variety. I'm picturing an apartment building where they got everybody in there who's going to be compatible. It just doesn't seem like a great way to build a real world.
Interesting. So it could confirm our bubbles, is Deborah's point. Thomas, what do you think of that?
I think you're absolutely right, and that is one of the big downsides of filters. And obviously, I mean, you mentioned the term filter babble, and in the context of information, in the context of Facebook, as we've seen in many now in the elections in the U.S., but also with Brexit or in the German elections, that is a huge problem. And basically, in scientific terms, the problem, new problem is called serendipity, right? So how do I find things that I don't know and that are not filtered by people who think like me? And concerning BlaBlaCar, I would assume it's fair to do so. It's fair to match preferences with people. Most of the, well, I think we have really differentiate here, particularly the context of political opinion and political information, and still the ability of markets to bring consumers or supply and demand together in the way that they fit to create better matches. But you're raising, right at the beginning of the show, you're raising obviously a very crucial point. And the way we started our conversation also obviously only now focused the beauty of data-rich markets and not all the problems that are coming along with them.
Let's go back to the opening vignette in the book, which is about people building human pyramids in Catalonia. which seems like a long way from big data, but what does this represent?
That example is a very good example of how people, that how important coordination of humans and human activity is. And for us, that vignette basically gives us an entry level in saying that markets are very good mechanisms to coordinate human activity. That what this example stands for in the book. And we have two main competing mechanisms in the economic world to coordinate. And the one is the market, and the other one is the firm. And we obviously always would consider that, well, companies are competing on markets, so that is complementary, which is obviously true. But there's another way to look at it. If you move a couple of steps back and look at it from a distance, we could only say markets and companies are in competition between themselves, in the sense that they are both mechanisms to coordinate economic activity and human activity. And so, yeah, so the pyramids of us was a sort of a metaphor to describe how complicated and how important and how beautiful human coordination and human cooperation is.
All right, and then the people are really stacking themselves in Catalonia, so they have to coordinate. Like, yes, you get on my shoulders now, and then so forth.
They're not doing it very well these days, I'm afraid. Yeah,
no,
yeah.
Now in Catalonia especially, right, with the separatism. So in this context, then, what you're saying in the book is that companies are becoming less important than markets over time, which I imagine is a little rough on the companies. They don't appreciate that very much.
And it's counterintuitive right now, right? Because we see the rise of the superstar firms. We're saying the companies as category become less important, and then we see new companies that are more valuable than any other companies in history before, the Apples, the Googles, the Facebooks, and so forth. And, well, if you have a closer look at it, to say that markets are thriving and companies are in retreat, and you look at the companies that are thriving, you realize very soon that what they do right now is they organize data-rich markets. That the strongest companies, either from the U.S. or their Asian counterparts like Alibaba, are now organizing the phenomenon we are describing. The powerful markets that bring supply and demand together in a much smarter way than the conventional markets did. And that will be on the expense of conventional companies who don't adapt.
All right, so the markets become more important, and therefore the companies that are capable of delivering people to those markets are the companies that become the most important.
That's true. And that is empirical evidence, I think.
Thomas Ramge is our guest. Let me let our listeners know we're talking to Thomas Ramge about the book he and Victor Meyer-Schoenberger wrote called Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. And there's a story in here about data helping old traditional markets, like what cell phones did to fishing in Kerala in India. What happened there?
Oh, yeah, That's a very nice anecdote we found in a Harvard study. Fishing on the coast of Kerala had always had the problem that the fish were concentrated in their schools in certain areas. So the fishermen that were successful basically had the choice to land their fish close to where they found that, but that basically meant that they had too much of fish in these particular markets, and that it was too hard for the fishermen to distribute, as they wouldn't know where to deliver it. And then about 15 years ago, there were cell phone technology was installed at the along the coastline, so that the fishermen on the boats would know where demand was and could coordinate through information the fish they just just gathered in a much more in a much more efficient way, and then match supply and demand in a much smarter way than they did before, where you had markets before where you had too much fish, and you had markets a couple miles down the coast where you didn't have any fish to sell and where the prices are very high. So that is a very good example of how digital technology, through the power of information, helped to make markets more efficient for the beneficiary of both sides, the suppliers and the customers.
But here's the point in the book where you realize, oh, wait, if somebody puts bad information in the market, that can also get out there. It can lead to bad decisions. I mean, has that politics aside, has that happened in markets?
Well, it's part of the nature of obviously it has, and we had seen the biggest blunder of it in the big financial crisis 2008 and 2009. However, by nature, markets are more resilient towards bad decisions than companies, because the nature of decision making in markets is decentralized, and the nature of decision making in companies is obviously command and control, hierarchical. And that means that if the top level of a company takes a bad decision, the whole company might stumble, as opposed to a flawed decision in a market with many, many market participants might be bad for that certain participant, but not for the market itself. And so that part of our hope in our book is that the economic systems with better informed markets will become less prone to big blunders as we had seen. But that obviously doesn't mean that data-rich markets are perfect, but what we definitely know by history is that markets with not enough information and not enough participants on the market that they're able to really process information in a good way are dangerous. And that is exactly what happened before 2008 with the subprime crisis in the U.S. that infected the whole world economy.
But, you know, you've got so many players in the game, and there were a few people, the economist Nouriel Roubini among them, saying, you know, this can't go on forever. We can't continue to have a one direction on the value of real estate, which is what's underpinning most of this bubble. And, of course, the bubble did burst then. So at some point you have human groupthink or something that overrules the force of the market, doesn't it?
Yeah. And the chance or the big opportunity of technology is, and digital technology is, that it is not as that it might help us to overcome our irrational economic behavior to a certain extent at least. And with better tools at hand for more people on the market that had seen the dangers in the market more clearly, maybe that wouldn't have happened.
So I mean, we do have machines involved in some of the decisions in the marketplace, don't we? I mean, we have machines that make stock trades all the time.
Sure, but obviously the main question is how good is the data they're fed in, how good are the algorithms trained and set up they're using. And before 2008, it is very obviously that humans as well as machines weren't really alerted in many senses.
Let's talk about data ontology. What is that?
A data ontology is a that's fairly difficult to describe. It's a way how to organize data so that as well machines as humans can make sense of it. That's a very simple way to put it.
All right, so you just put the stuff out there in a way that it's a matter of not it's you got the data. It's just a question of organizing it then.
The question to organize it and to make it searchable.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, it's sorting the data in a way that we can use filters and then find what we need.
Which is the real genius, I would think, of the likes of Amazon, is that Amazon figured out before anybody else did that if you're clicking on this, you're probably going to want this, and they were right more often than not.
Yeah, and Amazon is probably the prime company of the world in terms of smart ontologies. You're right. Uh-huh. And a very, very large part of the data capabilities of Amazon comes from their ability to set up the right ontologies and to sort the right data in the right structure.
All right, much more to talk about with Thomas Ramga. He's the co-author with Victor Meyer-Schoenberger of Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. We're getting a sense of just how different the world is in a time when you can get lots of information about a product in addition to the price without ever having to go anywhere near that product. But likewise, the people selling it to you get a lot of information about you as well. Big data, data-rich markets, defeating conventional markets, all this up for discussion. We'll come back and talk more with Thomas. And if you'd like to join us, we'll take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're getting an education in how the world works in the marketplace now. It's quite a bit different from the way things used to be. We've traveled a long way from pointing at things on shelves and having them given to us. We can do a lot more shopping by ourselves now. And the way that transactions happen is reliant more and more on having a lot of information about product and product having a lot of information in return about purchaser. This is the age of big data, and our guest is one of the co-authors of the book Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. It is written by Victor Meyer-Schoenberger and Thomas Ramga. Thomas Ramga is the technology correspondent for the business magazine Brand 1, and he also writes for The Economist and has been involved in a lot of business journalism over the years. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. I love this line in the book. You say that Jeff Bezos makes ordinary control freaks look like stoned hippies. Jeff Bezos, of course, the boss at Amazon.
Well, that's a quote of a former employee of him that became quite famous on the internet. Mm-hmm. You're not quoting us here.
Okay.
I don't want to get any letters from very, very expensive American lawyers. So no. Please make sure that this is not what we said, but this is a quote we quote.
Okay, your quote of somebody else saying it. All right, so but the point being that this is where Amazon again has excelled. Is Amazon has gone far beyond anybody before it in figuring out how to narrow down the set of choices so people can go, oh, this is the thing I want.
Yeah, sure. I mean the interesting part of Amazon, there are many interesting aspects if you look at the organization of Amazon and its ability to make sense of data and customer data in order to give the right recommendations that with a high likelihood will people then follow and buy and click the buy button. But the quote you were quoting is basically about how that the organization of Amazon itself is not very digital, that it is very command and control, like a very, very traditional hierarchical organization. But they found a way to combine both, to be on the one hand a very, very strict organization with very, very strict, famously strict labor standards and so forth, people working extremely hard, even more harder than in other Silicon Valley companies and so forth. And on the other hand, still sort of tap into this richness of data and innovative approaches to make sense of data, customer data. And that led up to now to market shares that are very obviously beyond what most people would consider to be competitive markets. I mean, they obviously tend to have market shares of which the old steel barons would envy them for. And that's part of our book, is to also obviously look at how these huge companies that tend to become data monopolies have to be regulated in a new way.
Well, all right, that's the next question then, because you do see the rise of companies and governments using the new order to damage markets and even democracy. So what kind of regulatory regime do you favor, particularly when so many people clearly don't mind giving up a lot of information as long as they get to chat with their friends and buy the stuff they want?
What we, our look at it is that we have to look at the market share of these companies. And if these companies sort of become more and more powerful by dominating certain markets, if you look at the search market of Google, which is close to a monopoly now, or if you look at the Amazon online markets that are obviously not a monopoly yet, but are gaining powerful positions that would have not been accepted in former times by competition law. We have to find new ways how to regulate these companies that they're so strong in using data in order to drive their business. And the main proposition that we make is that they have to share the data. We call it the progressive data sharing mandate, which basically means that if a company, a digital company, gains a market share over a certain threshold, it has to share parts of its data and a progressive amount of its data with its competitors in order to make sure that we'll have competition in that field.
Well, that's interesting. So when they get above 60, 70, some percentage, whatever the number is, beyond
it's
that
much
point.
Much lower than that.
Or it's much lower,
lower
than
that. Mm-hmm. It's 10 to 20% when they have to start to give up a certain amount of the data. Yeah, because the driving forces of the digital companies are so strong, because they sort of combine classic drivers like scale effects and what we've seen, what they call the networks effects in the platform economy of the last 20 years, and now with machine learning, what we call the feedback effects, which basically means getting customer feedback data in order to improve their products. That in our understanding, all what we've seen in all the tendencies we've seen recently in the last 20 years will only increase in terms of monopolization of data and business. And so our understanding is that the regulators, the governments, will have to make sure that the source of the wealth of these companies, which is data, has to be shared in order to create a level playing field in the future.
So two questions here, both of them more or less about Google. First of all, in America, it's just become the phrase, you know, Google that rather than say search that. Is it pretty much the same thing in Europe now?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, the market share for search is the same in Europe as in the U.S. It's very close to 100%.
Mm-hmm. All right, so then the other question is, are there inroads toward regulation? I know that some European, in some cases, the EU is a little harder on Microsoft, for example, than American regulators are. And I just wonder if there's some discussion of the kind of thing you're talking about already underway.
Well, yeah, it is. And we've just had a huge European initiative called New Data and the European Data Regulation, which focuses very much on privacy.
Oh, and so you can get your stuff to disappear from the web, is that right?
That is part of it, or you can take the data that you have with a certain company to the next company. For example, if you change the bank, which basically means that it basically means that the data that you are that you are creating in the IT systems of the company is still yours, and you can take it with you. While obviously the standard all over the world right now is that you check two boxes when you become a customer or a member of a community, And from that point on, you completely lost any control of the data you create within these systems. And you leave all the control to Google or Facebook or Uber or whoever. And German, European regulation, which has been very much inspired by the German data protection law, is now trying to give at least some power back to the consumers. And the the right to delete the data that you have is part of it, but also that you can take the data that you left at a certain company with you to another company, which then basically plays very much in favor of what we discussed before, the data sharing. That our vision, Victor and my vision in the book, is that data will enrich markets and consumers and wealth and matching in many ways. But the big threat is monopolization. And every mean that helps us to increase competition in digital markets will play in favor of the whole market and therefore on the common good in total.
All right, so let me be clear about what it is you're saying has to be shared above a certain market share. It is the data, not the proprietary information about how they've accumulated the data. Is that right?
That is absolutely right. We're not in favor of algorithm transparency, therefore. This is what in the traditional world has been classical intellectual property. What we basically want is that the main source of information that is not only created by the company that gives you a certain offer online, but also by the interaction of the consumer, is not on the only disposal of the company that has the IT systems, but that this is more or less common good or private good, and private good which belongs to the person that has created the data through its online interaction, meaning the consumer, the member, the client, but not only the company that has set up the IT systems.
Well, so you're not asking any company to part with its proprietary stuff, its intellectual property, but they're being told they would have to, in this circumstance, under this regulation vision, be forced to part with raw data. Is there still a fair amount of grumbling, like we can't make any money if we have to do this, that sort of thing?
I think that's not the biggest problem of the world right now. If the revenues of Apple or Google or Alibaba or Facebook are declining a little bit, and no, we haven't heard that yet. Mm-hmm. That problem. They don't. They might consider it to be unfair, but they know that the situation we have right now, that you click two boxes and from that point on all the data that you create belongs to another company and nobody else has the ability to take it back or to delete it or to give it towards another use, that this is a fair situation. But that is how it is right now, and part of the core messages of our book is that we have to change that.
We're talking largely about ourselves as consumers, but I want to do touch briefly before we go about the issue of workers. I mean, if we're talking about a set of efficient markets where transactions are made very much more tailor-made, I mean, is there going to be enough job activity to go on? Is there going to be enough employment for all the people who are going to need it in a world of 8-9 billion people?
Good question. I mean, and every single time in the history of technology when you had a new technology disrupting or heavily influencing labor markets, you had losers. The question is, will this time with machine learning and digital technology happen the same what happened every time before, that after a time lag, the new technology creates more jobs than it had destroyed in the first wave? And, I'm an optimistic person. I don't see many reasons why humans won't be creative enough in the future to understand that what we see now as a new wave of technology is just a new wave of tools. And that those new tools, what they basically do is they automate decisions, routine decisions, that had been done by humans. What is a truck driver doing? He's basically making many, many small routine decisions while driving his truck. And these decisions can, in the future, be taken by a machine, and therefore, there's no job for the truck driver anymore. However, in economic terms, that might be very bad for the truck driver. And politics have to find solutions, what to do, how to train 2 million or 3 million truck drivers that not any more needed on the American labor market. However, in economic terms, it's obviously good that the machine does stuff that had been done, rather dull stuff that had been done by humans. The true question is, are humans in the future innovative and creative enough to find new work in things that can't be automated? And I'm optimistic. I think this will happen. That will shift work from dull type of works to more creative. So more creative type of works, or much more compassionate type of works. And there lies a huge chance, as if the world wouldn't need more compassion. And people that deal professionally by helping others in a compassionate way.
Well, that's a great place to end it. Thank you so much for joining us. So the book is called Reinventing Capitalism in the Age of Big Data. Victor Meyer-Schoenberger and Thomas Ramga. Thomas has been our guest, and thank you again.